along the dirt path. The door to the monastery seemed a long way off, and suddenly he wished he was back in the blessed chapel, where it was calm and peaceful, listening to the monotone chants, clinging to the chants. No chaos there, no thoughts, no decisions, no raw emotions. Deep breath in, deep breath out. Frère Mathieu was a gifted musician, Frère Bernard was saying. He turned our vocation of singing chants into something sublime. He was a great teacher and a natural leader. He gave our lives new meaning and purpose. He breathed life into the abbey. Then why wasn't he abbot? It was working. Beauvoir followed his breath and the monk's quiet voice back into his own body. Perhaps he should have been. But Dom Philippe was elected. Over Frère Mathieu? No, Frère Mathieu didn't run. Did Dom Philippe get in by acclamation? No, the prior at the time ran. Most expected him to win, since it was a natural progression. The prior almost always became the abbot. And who was the prior at the time? Beauvoir's mind was working again, taking things in and churning rational questions back out. But the fist in his belly remained. I was. Beauvoir wasn't sure he heard right. You were the prior? Yes, and Dom Philippe was just plain old Frère Philippe, a regular monk. It must have been humiliating. Frère Bernard smiled. We try not to personalize these things. It was God's will. And that makes it better? I'd rather be humiliated by men than God himself. Bernard chose not to answer. So you go back to being a regular monk, and the abbot appoints his friend as prior, Frère Mathieu. Bernard nodded, and absently took a handful of blueberries from his basket. Did you resent the new prior? Asked Beauvoir, helping himself to some of the berries. Not at all. It turned out to be an inspired choice. The former abbot and I were a good team, but I wouldn't have been as good a prior to Dom Philippe as Frère Mathieu proved. It worked well for many years. So you had to suck it up. You have a singular way of putting things. You should hear what I'm not saying, Beauvoir said, and saw Frère Bernard smile. Have you heard that the prior was considering replacing Frère Antoine as soloist? With Frère Luc? Yes. It was a rumour spread by Frère Luc, and apparently believed by him, but no one else. Are you sure it wasn't true? The prior could be difficult. I think, Frère Bernard shot Beauvoir a glance, you might call him an asshole. I'm hurt. But he knew music. Gregorian chant was more than just music to him. It was his path to the divine. He would rather die than do anything to undermine the choir or the chants. Frère Bernard walked on, apparently unaware of what he'd said. But Beauvoir tucked it away. Frère Antoine should be soloist, said the monk, nibbling at more berries. He has a magnificent voice. Better than Luc's? Far better. Frère Luc's is better technically. He can control it. It has a beautiful tone, but there's nothing divine there. It's like seeing a painting of a person instead of the real thing. It's missing a dimension. Frère Bernard's opinion of Luc's voice was almost exactly the same as Frère Antoine's. Still, the young monk had been convinced, and convincing. If Luc was right, ventured Beauvoir, what would the reaction have been? Bernard thought about that for a moment. I think people would have wondered. Wondered what? Now Frère Bernard was distinctly uncomfortable. He popped more berries into his mouth. The basket, once overflowing, had been reduced to a puddle of blueberries. Just wondered. You're not telling me everything, Frère Bernard. Bernard remained silent, swallowing his thoughts and opinions and words along with the berries. But Beauvoir had a pretty good idea what he meant. You'd have wondered at their relationship. Bernard's mouth clamped shut, the muscles around his jaw bulging with the effort of keeping the words in. You'd have wondered, Beauvoir pressed, what was going on between the older prior and the new recruit. That's not what I meant. Of course it is. You and the other monks would have wondered what happened after choir practice, when the rest of you went back to your cells. No, You're wrong. Is that how Antoine got his job? Was he more than just a soloist, and Frère Mathieu more than just a choirmaster? Stop, snapped Frère Bernard. It wasn't like that. Then what was it like? You're making the chance, the choir, sordid. Mathieu was a deeply unpleasant man. I didn't like him at all. But even I know that never, Bernard hissed the words, never would he have chosen a soloist in exchange for sex. Frère Mathieu loved the chance, above all else. But still, said Beauvoir, his voice very quiet now, you would have wondered. Frère Bernard stared at Beauvoir, his eyes wide. His hand around the handle of the basket showed a strip of white knuckles. Did you know that the abbot has made Frère Antoine the new choirmaster? Beauvoir's voice was friendly, conversational, as though the confrontation hadn't just happened. It was a trick he'd learned from Gamache. Don't keep attacking. Move forward, back, sideways, stand still. Be unpredictable. Slowly Frère Bernard gathered himself and took a deep breath in, a deep breath out. It doesn't surprise me, he finally said. It's the sort of thing the abbot would do. Go on. A few minutes ago you asked why I'm the abbot's man. This is why. Only a saint or a fool would promote an adversary. Dom Philippe's no fool. You think he's a saint? Frère Bernard shrugged. I don't know, but I think he's the closest we have. Why do you think he was elected abbot? What did he have to offer? He was just a quiet little monk going about his day. He wasn't a leader. He wasn't a great administrator. He wasn't a fine musician. He brought almost no actual skills to the community. He wasn't a plumber or carpenter or stonemason. Then what is he? He's a man of God, the real deal. He believes with all his heart and soul, and he inspires that in others. If people hear the divine when we sing, Dom Philippe put it there. He makes us better men and better monks. He believes in God, and he believes in the power of love and forgiveness, and not just a faith of convenience. If you ever needed proof, look at what he just did. He made Frère Antoine choirmaster, because it was the right thing to do, for the choir, for the chants, and for the peace of the community. That just makes him a savvy politician, not a saint. You're a skeptic, Monsieur Beauvoir. And for good reason, Frère Bernard. Someone killed your prior, bashed his head in the abbot's pretty little garden. You talk of saints. Where was the saint then? Where was God then? Bernard said nothing. Oui, snapped Beauvoir. I'm a skeptic. Will no one rid me of this troublesome priest? Someone had. And your precious abbot wasn't simply elected out of the blue, Beauvoir reminded him. He chose to run. He wanted the job. Does a saint seek power? I thought they were supposed to be humble. They were within sight of the gate now. Inside were the long, light hallways and small cells, and silent, gliding monks, and Chief Inspector Gamache, and Francoeur, together. Beauvoir was a little surprised the walls and foundations of the monastery weren't shaking. They approached the door, made of thick wood cut from this forest 400 years ago, and then hinges were forged, and a deadbolt, and a lock. On the rolled paper in Beauvoir's hand, Saint-Gilbert-entre-les-Loups looked like a crucifix, but in reality, it looked like a prison. Beauvoir stopped. Why is the door locked? He asked Frère Bernard. A tradition, nothing more. I expect lots of what we do seems senseless, but our rules and traditions make sense to us. Still Beauvoir stared. A door is locked as protection, he finally said. But who's being protected? Pardon? You said your slogan could be, just in case. Exist operatus. Yes, it was a joke. Beauvoir nodded. A lot of truth is said in jest, or so I've heard. Just in case of what, mon frère? What are the locked doors for? To keep the world out, or the monks in? To protect you, or protect us? I don't understand, said Frère Bernard. But Beauvoir could see by his expression that he understood perfectly well. He could also see that the monk's basket, with its mother load of berries, was now empty. the perfect offering gone. Maybe your precious abbot was neither a savvy politician nor a saint, but a jailer. Maybe that's why he was so against another recording, so adamant about keeping the vow of silence. Was he just enforcing a long tradition of silence? Or was the abbot afraid of loosing some monster into the world? "I can't believe you just said that," said Bernard, trembling with the effort to contain himself. "Are you talking about pedophilia? Do you think we're here because we violated little boys? Do you think Brother Charles, Brother Simon, the abbot?" he sputtered. "I? You can't possibly." He could go no further. His face was red with rage, and Beauvoir wondered if his head might explode. But still, the homicide inspector said nothing. He waited and waited. Finally, silence was his friend, and this monk's enemy, because in that silence sat a spectre, fully grown, fully fleshed. Of all the little boys, all the choir boys, the school boys, the altar boys, the trusting boys, and their parents, that lived forever in the silence of the church. When given a choice, given free will, the church had chosen to protect the priests. And how better to protect those clerics than to send them into the wilderness, to an order all but extinct, and build a wall around them, where they could sing but not speak. Was Dom Philippe as much guard as abbot, a saint who kept watch over sinners? Chapter 19. Do you know why the Gilbertines have black robes and white hoods? It's unique, you know. No other order wears it. Chief Superintendent Sylvain Francois was sitting behind the prior's desk, leaning back casually in the hard chair, his long legs crossed. Chief Inspector Gamache was now in the visitor's chair, on the other side of the desk. He was trying to read the coroner's report and the other papers Francois had brought with him. He looked up and saw the superintendent smiling. It was an attractive smile, not slimy, not condescending. It was warm and confident, the smile of a man you could trust.
No, sir. Why do they?
Francois had arrived at the office 20 minutes earlier and given the reports to Gamache. He then proceeded to interrupt the chief's reading with trivial statements. Gamache recognized it as a twist on an old interrogation technique, designed to irritate, to annoy. Interrupt, 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 until the subject finally exploded and said far more than they normally would have out of frustration at not being allowed to say anything at all. It was subtle and time-consuming, this wearing away at a person's patience, not used by the brash young agent of today, but the older officers knew it, and knew, if they waited long enough, it was almost always effective. The chief superintendent of the Sûreté was using it on his head of homicide. Gamache, as he listened politely to Francois's mundane observations, wondered why. Was it just for fun, to toy with him? Or was there, as there always was with the chief superintendent, some deeper purpose? Gamache looked into that charming face and wondered what was going on inches from the smile, in that rotting brain, in that Byzantine mind. As much as Jean-Guy might consider this man an idiot, Gamache knew he wasn't. No one rose to be the most senior officer in Quebec, in one of the most respected forces in the world, without having skills. To dismiss Francois as a fool would be a grave mistake, though Gamache could never totally shake the impression Beauvoir was partly right. While Francois wasn't an idiot, he wasn't as clever as he appeared, and certainly not as clever as he thought he was. After all, Francois was skilled enough to use an old and subtle interrogation technique, but arrogant enough to use it on someone who'd almost certainly recognized what it was. He was really more cunning than clever. But that didn't make him less dangerous. Gamache looked down at the coroner's report in his hands. In 20 minutes, he'd only managed to read a single page. It showed the prior to be a healthy man in his early 60s. The usual wear and tear on a 60-year-old body, some slight arthritis, some hardening of the arteries. "I looked up the Gilbertine as soon as I'd heard about the prior's murder." Francois's voice was agreeable, authoritative. People not only trusted this man, they believed him. Gamache lifted his eyes from the page and put a politely interested look on his face.
Is that right?
I'd read some of the newspaper articles, of course, said the superintendent, moving his eyes from Gamache to gaze out the narrow slat of the window. The news coverage, when their recording was such a hit. Do you have it?
I do.
So do I. I don't understand the attraction myself. Dull. But lots liked it. Do you?
I do.
Francois gave him a small smile. I thought you might. Gamache waited, quietly watching the superintendent, as though he had all the time in the world, and the paper in his hand was far less interesting than whatever his boss was saying.
A cause of sensation. Amazing to think these monks have been here for hundreds of years, and no one seemed to notice. And then they do one little recording, and voila, world famous. Well, that's the problem, of course.
How so?
There's going to be an uproar when news of Frère Mathieu's murder gets out. He's more famous than Frère Jacques.
Francois smiled, and to Gamache's surprise, the superintendent sang.
Frère Jacques, Frère Jacques, dormez-vous, dormez-vous.
But he sang the cheerful child's song like a dirge, slowly, sonorously, as though there was some meaning hidden in the nonsense verse. Then Francois stared for a long, cold moment at Gamache.
There's going to be hell to pay, Armand. Even you must have figured that out.
Yes, I had. Merci.
Gamache leaned forward and placed the coroner's report on the desk between them. He stared directly at Francois, who stared back, not blinking, his eyes cold and hard, daring the chief inspector to speak, which he did.
Why are you here?
I've come to help.
Forgive me, superintendent, said Gamache, but I'm still not sure why you came. You've never felt the need to help before.
The two men glared at each other. The air between them throbbed with enmity.
In a murder investigation, I mean, said Gamache, with a smile.
Though, of course.
Francois looked at Gamache with barely disguised loathing.
With communications down, the superintendent looked at the laptop on the desk, and only one phone in the monastery, it was clear someone would need to bring those.
He waved at the dossier on the desk. The coroner's report and the findings of the forensics team.
That is extremely helpful, said Gamache,
and meant it.
But he knew, and Francois knew, that it didn't take the chief superintendent of the Sûreté to act as courier. In fact, it would have been far more helpful, if that really was the goal, to have one of Gamache's homicide investigators bring it.
Since you're here to help, perhaps you'd like me to give you the facts of the case, Gamache offered.
Please. Gamache spent the next 2 minutes trying to give Superintendent Francois the facts, while the superintendent continually interrupted with meaningless questions and comments, most suggesting Gamache might have missed something, or failed to ask something, or failed to investigate something. But, haltingly, Gamache managed to tell the story of the murder of Frère Mathieu. The body, curled around the yellowed paper with the neumes and Latin gibberish, the three monks praying over the dead prior in the garden, the abbot, Dom Philippe, his secretary, Frère Simon, and the doctor, Frère Charles. The evidence of an increasingly bitter rift in Saint-Gilbert, between those who wanted the vow of silence lifted and another recording of Gregorian chants made, and those who wanted neither, between the prior's men and the abbot's men. Through constant interruptions, Gamache told the superintendent about the hidden chapter house and the abbot's secret garden, the rumours of more hidden rooms, and even a treasure. At that, the superintendent looked at Gamache as though at a credulous child. Gamache simply continued, giving concise character sketches of the monks.
"It seems you're no closer to solving the murder than when you arrived," said Francois. "Everyone's still a suspect."
"It's a good thing that you're here, then," Gamache paused. "To help."
"It is. For instance, you don't even have the murder weapon."
"That's true."
"Or even know what it was."
Gamache opened his mouth to say they suspected a rock from the garden had crushed the prior's skull, then was tossed over the wall and into the woods. But instinct, and perhaps a slight gleam of satisfaction in Francois's eyes, told him to stop. Instead, he looked at the superintendent, then down at the mostly unread coroner's report. He turned the page and scanned, then looked up, meeting Francois's eyes. The gleam had become a glow of triumph. Gamache cupped his right hand in his left, holding it steady, so that Francois wouldn't see the slight tremble and believe he'd caused it.
"You read the reports?" Gamache asked.
Francois nodded. "On the flight. You've been looking for a rock, I understand." He made it sound ridiculous.
"That's true. Clearly we were wrong. It wasn't a rock at all."
No. Francois uncrossed his legs and leaned forward. No dirt or residue in the wound. Nothing at all. As you see, the coroner thinks it was a long metal object, like a pipe or a poker."
"You knew this when you arrived and didn't tell me?"
Gamache's voice was calm, but the censure was clear. "What? Me presume to tell the great Gamache how to do his job? I wouldn't dream of it."
"Then why are you here, if not to pass on valuable information?"
"Because, Armand," Francois spat the name out as though it was merd in his mouth, "one of us cares for the service, and one of us cares about his career. I'm here so that when news of the murder gets out and all hell breaks loose and the world's media descends, we don't look like complete imbeciles. I can at least give the impression the Sûreté is competent, that we're doing all we can to solve the brutal killing of one of the most beloved religieux in the world. You know what the world will want to know when his murder is made public?" Gamache remained quiet. He knew that while continually interrupting could cause an explosion of information, silence could too. A man like Francois, so tightly restraining his rage, needed simply to be given space, and perhaps a well-timed shove.
"Why, with only 24 suspects in a cloistered abbey, the famed Sûreté du Québec still couldn't make an arrest," Francois sneered. "What could possibly be taking so long, they'll ask." "And what will you tell them, Silver? That it's difficult to get at the truth when your own people are withholding information?" "The truth, Armand? You want me to tell them that an arrogant, smug, incompetent asshole is in charge of the investigation?"
Gamache raised his brows and faintly gestured toward where Francois was sitting, behind the desk. And Gamache saw Francois slip over the edge. The superintendent stood, and the stone floor screamed as the chair scraped against it. Francois's handsome face was livid. Gamache remained seated, but after a moment he slowly, slowly got to his feet, so that they faced each other across the desk. Gamache's hands were behind his back, clasping each other. His chest was exposed, as though inviting Francois to take his best shot. There was a soft tapping on the door. Neither man responded. Then it came again, and a tentative, "Chief?" The door opened a crack.
"You need to treat your people with more respect, Armand," snapped Francois, his voice loud. Then he turned to the door. "Come."
Beauvoir stepped in and looked from man to man. It was near impossible to enter the prior's office, so thick was the atmosphere. But Beauvoir did. He stepped in and stood shoulder to shoulder with Gamache. Francois dragged his stare from the chief inspector over to Beauvoir and took a deep breath, and even managed a coy smile.
"You've come at a good time, Inspector. I think your chief and I have said enough, perhaps even more than enough."
He gave a disarming little laugh and put out his hand.
"I didn't get a chance to say hello when I arrived. My apologies, Inspector Beauvoir."
Jean-Guy hesitated, then took it. A bell rang, and Beauvoir made a face. "Not again." Superintendent Francois laughed.
"My feelings exactly. But perhaps while the monks go about their business of praying, we can go about ours. At least we'll know where they are."
He all but winked at Beauvoir, then turned back to Gamache.
"Think about what I said, Chief Inspector."
His voice was warm, almost cordial.
"That's all I ask."
He made to leave, and Gamache called after him.
"I think, Chief Superintendent, you'll find that bell isn't for prayers, but for lunch."
Well, Francois smiled fully,
then my prayers are answered. I hear the food here is excellent.
Is it? He asked Beauvoir. Not bad.
Bon.
Then I'll see you at lunch. I'll be staying a few days, of course. The abbot has been good enough to give me one of the rooms. If you excuse me, I'll just freshen up and meet you there." He nodded to both of them, then walked off confidently, a man in complete command of himself, of the situation, of the monastery. Beauvoir turned to Gamache. "What was that about?"
"I honestly haven't a clue."
"You all right?"
"Just fine, thank you."
"Fucked up, insecure, neurotic and egotistical, fine?"
"I think that would be the chief superintendent's assessment."
Gamache smiled, and they walked down the corridor toward the Blessed Chapel and the dining hall.
"He came here to tell you that?"
"No. According to him, he came to help. He also brought with him the coroner's report and the findings of the forensics team."
Gamache told Beauvoir what the report said. Beauvoir listened as they walked, then stopped and turned to Gamache in anger. "He knew that's what the report said, that the weapon wasn't a rock at all, and he didn't tell us right away? What's he playing at?"
"I don't know. But we need to focus on the murder, not be distracted by the superintendent."
"D'accord," agreed Beauvoir begrudgingly. "So where's the damned murder weapon? We searched outside the wall and didn't find anything. Except," he thought, "wild blueberries. And they probably weren't lethal, until dipped in dark chocolate."
"I know one thing," said the chief. "The report tells us something crucial."
"What?"
"The murder of Frère Mathieu was almost certainly premeditated. If you're in a garden, you might pick up a rock in a moment of overwhelming emotion and kill someone."
"But not a piece of metal," said Beauvoir, following the chief's thoughts. "That had to be brought with the murderer. There's no way a pipe or a poker would just be lying around the abbot's garden." Gamache nodded. One of the monks hadn't just lashed out at the prior, killing him in a fit of rage. It was planned. Mens rea. The Latin legal phrase came to Gamache. Mens rea. A guilty mind. Intent. One of these monks had met the prior in the garden, already armed with a metal pipe and a guilty mind. The thought and the act collided, and the result was murder. "I can't believe Francois is staying," said Beauvoir, as they crossed the Blessed Chapel. "I'll admit to the crime myself, if it means that stupid shit'll leave." Gamache stopped. They were dead in the center of the chapel.
"Be careful, Jean-Guy."
Gamache kept his voice low.
"Superintendent Francois's no fool."
"Are you kidding? As soon as he stepped off the plane, he should have handed you the dossier. But instead he ignores you, in front of everyone, and sucks up to the abbot."
"Lower your voice," cautioned Gamache.
Beauvoir gave a furtive glance around, then spoke in an urgent whisper.
"The man's a menace."
He glanced toward the door from the corridor for Francois. Gamache turned, and they resumed their walk to the dining hall.
"Look," Beauvoir hurried to catch up to the chief's long strides. "He's undermining you here. You must see that. Everyone saw what happened on the dock, and they now think Francois's in charge."
Gamache opened the door and motioned Beauvoir through to the next corridor. The aroma of fresh baked bread and soup met them. Then, with a swift glance behind him into the dimness of the Blessed Chapel, Gamache closed the door.
"He is in charge, Jean-Guy."
"Oh, come on."
But the laughter died on Beauvoir's lips. The chief was serious.
"He's the chief superintendent of the Sûreté," said Gamache. "I'm not. He's my boss. He'll always be in charge."
At the thunderous look on Beauvoir's face, Gamache smiled.
"It'll be all right."
"I know it will, patron. After all, nothing bad ever happens when a senior Sûreté officer starts abusing his power."
"Exactly, mon vieux."
The chief grinned and caught Beauvoir's eye.
"Please, Jean-Guy, stay out of it."
Beauvoir didn't need to ask, out of what? Chief Inspector Gamache's calm brown eyes held his. There was a plea in them. Not for help, but for the opposite. To be left alone to deal with Francois. Beauvoir nodded.
"Oui, patron."
But he knew he'd just lied. Chapter 20. Most of the monks were already in the dining room by the time Gamache and Beauvoir arrived.
The chief inspector nodded to the abbot, who sat at the head of the long table, an empty chair beside him. The abbot lifted his hand in greeting, but didn't offer the seat. Neither did the chief offer to join him. Both men had other agendas. Baskets of fresh baguettes, rounds of cheeses, pitchers of water, and bottles of cider sat on the wooden table, and monks sat around it in their black robes, white hoods hanging down their backs. Gamache realized Superintendent Francois hadn't told him why Gilbert of Sempringham had chosen this unique design 900 years ago.
"That's Brother Raymond," whispered the chief, nodding toward a space on the bench between the doctor, Frère Charles, and another monk. "He's in charge of maintenance."
"Got it," said Beauvoir, and walked quickly to the other side of the table. "Do you mind?" Beauvoir asked the monks.
"Not at all," said Frère Charles. He looked happy, indeed almost hysterically so, to see the Sûreté agent. It was a welcome Beauvoir rarely received while on a murder investigation.
Gamache's lunch companion, on the other hand, looked far from pleased to see him. He looked far from pleased to see the bread, or the cheese, or the sun in the sky, or the birds outside the window.
"Bonjour, Frère Simon," said the chief, taking his seat.
But apparently the abbot's secretary was maintaining his own strict personal vow of silence. He also seemed to have taken a vow of annoyance. Across the table, and a little way down, Gamache could see that Beauvoir was already engaged in conversation with Brother Raymond.
"The first brothers knew what they were doing," said Raymond, in answer to Beauvoir's question about the original plans for the abbey.
His answer surprised Beauvoir, not for the content, but for the monk's voice. He spoke in a broad, almost unintelligible country accent, a twang yanked from the woods and mountains and tiny villages of Quebec. It had been planted by the first settlers and voyageurs from France hundreds of years ago. Rugged men, schooled in what mattered here, not politesse, but survival. The aristocrats, the learned administrators and mariners might have found the new world, but the hardy peasants had settled it. Their voices had taken deep root in Quebec, like some ancient oak, unchanged for centuries. So that a historian speaking to these Quebecois might feel she'd travelled in time back to medieval France. Over the generations, most Quebecois had lost the accent. But every now and then this voice emerged from a valley, from a village. It had become popular to mock such accents, thinking if the voice was rustic, the thinking must be backward too. But Beauvoir knew different. His grandmother spoke like this, as they shelled peas on the rickety old veranda, as she talked about her garden, and the seasons, and patience, and nature. His gruff grandfather, when he chose to speak, also sounded like a peasant. But he thought and acted like a nobleman, never failing to help a neighbour, never failing to share what little he had. No, Beauvoir had no inclination to dismiss Frère Raymond. Just the opposite. He felt drawn to this monk. Raymond's eyes were deep brown, and despite the robe, Beauvoir could see the monk's body was strappy. His hands were lean and sinewy from a lifetime of hard work. He was, Beauvoir guessed, in his early 50s.
"They built Saint-Gilbert to last," said Frère Raymond, reaching for the cider bottle and pouring some for Beauvoir and himself. "Craftsmanship, that's what it was, and discipline. But after those first monks, disaster."
What followed was a litany of how every generation of monks had screwed up the monastery in their own special way. Not spiritually. Frère Raymond didn't seem too concerned with that, but physically. Adding stuff, taking down stuff, adding it again, changing the roof, all disasters.
"And the toilet. Don't get me started on the toilet."
But it was too late. Frère Raymond was started. And Beauvoir began to understand why Frère Charles was almost maniacally pleased to have someone come between him and Brother Raymond. Not because of the voice, but what that voice was saying, non-stop.
"They messed those up," said Brother Raymond. "The toilet were..."
"A disaster?" asked Beauvoir.
"Exactement."
Raymond knew he was in the company of a kindred spirit. The last few monks arrived and took their seats. A chief superintendent Francois paused in the doorway. The room grew quiet, except for Frère Raymond, who couldn't seem to stop the locomotive of words.
"Shit,
Great halls of it. I can show you if you like.
Brother Raymond looked at Beauvoir with enthusiasm, but Beauvoir shook his head and looked over at Francais.
Merci, mon frère, he whispered, but I've seen enough shits.
Frère Raymond snorted.
Me too.
And then he grew quiet. Superintendent Francais had a way of dominating a room. Beauvoir watched as, one by one, the monks turned to the superintendent. He's fooled them too, thought Beauvoir. Surely men of God would see behind the fake front. They'd see the meanness, the pettiness. They'd see he was a nasty piece of shit, a disaster. But they didn't seem to, just as many in the Sûreté didn't either. They were fooled by Francais' bravado, his manliness, his swagger. Beauvoir could see the testosterone-filled world of the Sûreté being taken in, but not the quiet and thoughtful monks. But they too seemed in awe of this man who'd arrived so swiftly, flying in and landing almost on top of them. Nothing effete, nothing tentative about Francais. He'd practically fallen from the sky, into their abbey, into their laps. And judging by the look on their faces, they seemed to admire him for that. But not all of them, Beauvoir realized. His blueberry-picking companion from that morning, Frère Bernard, was looking at Francais with suspicion, as were a few others. Perhaps these monks weren't quite as naive as Beauvoir had feared. But then he had it. The abbot's men were looking at Francois with wariness, their faces polite but veiled. It was the prior's men who were practically swooning. Francois's gaze swept the room and came to rest on the abbot and the empty chair beside him. The air seemed to leave the room as all eyes swung from the superintendent to the chair, then back again. Dom Philippe sat perfectly still at the head of the table, neither inviting the superintendent to join him nor discouraging it. Finally, Francois gave a small, respectful bow to the monks and walked purposefully down the long table, to the head, and took his place on the right-hand side of the abbot. The prior's seat filled, the void filled, the vacuum filled. Beauvoir returned his attention to Frère Raymond, and was surprised to see a look of admiration on the lean and weathered face as he too watched the superintendent.
"The prior's place, of course," said Raymond. "The king is dead. Long live the king."
The prior was king? I thought the abbot would be considered that. Frère Raymond gave Beauvoir a keen, assessing look.
"In name only. The prior was our real leader."
"You're one of the prior's men?" asked Beauvoir, surprised. He'd have thought this man would be loyal to the abbot.
"Absolutely. I can only take incompetence so long. He..."
Frère Raymond jerked his shaved head toward the abbot.
"Is ruining the abbey. The prior was going to save it."
"Ruining? How?"
"By doing nothing."
Raymond kept his voice low, but his annoyance scraped out anyway.
"The prior had handed him the means to make all the money we'd ever need, to finally fix the abbey so that it'd stand 1,000 years, and Dom Philippe turned it away."
"But I thought lots of work had been done. The kitchens, the roof, the geo. The abbot wasn't exactly doing nothing."
"But he wasn't doing what was really needed. We could have survived just fine for a while without a new kitchen or geothermal."
Frère Raymond paused. It was as though a void had suddenly opened up in the flow of words. Beauvoir stared and waited, as Frère Raymond teetered on the edge of silence or more words. Beauvoir decided to give him a little push. "What can't you survive without?" The monk lowered his voice further.
"The foundations are rotten."
And now Beauvoir wasn't sure if Frère Raymond was speaking metaphorically, as les religieux tended to do, or for real. But he thought this monk, with this accent, probably didn't go in for metaphors.
"What do you mean?"
Beauvoir also whispered.
"How many ways are there to interpret that?"
Raymond asked.
"The foundations are rotten. Is that a big job? Are you kidding? You've seen the monastery. If the foundations go, the monastery collapses."
Beauvoir stared at the intense monk, whose eyes were boring into him. "Collapses? The monastery will fall down?"
"Oh, completely. Not today, not tomorrow. I'd say we have about 10 years. But it'll take that long to repair. The foundations have supported the weight of the walls for hundreds of years.
said Raymond.
It's amazing what those first monks did, way ahead of their time. But they hadn't counted on the terrible winters, the cycles of freezing and thawing, and what that does. And something else.
What?
The forest. Saint-Gilbert entre les loups is fixed in place, but the forest keeps moving, toward us. Roots are breaking through the foundations, cracking them, making them weak. Then water got in. The foundations are crumbling and rotting.
Rotting, thought Beauvoir. It wasn't a metaphor, but it could be. When we arrived, we noticed many of the trees around the monastery had been cut down recently, said Beauvoir. Is this why?
Too little, too late. The damage is done. The roots are already here. It'll take millions to repair. And all sorts of skilled workers. But he...
Now Raymond jerked his knife toward the abbot.
Thinks 2 dozen aging monks can do the work. He's not only incompetent, he's delusional.
Beauvoir would have to agree. He watched the abbot in what appeared to be polite conversation with the superintendent, and, for the first time, wondered about his sanity. What does he say when you tell him it's impossible for you to fix the foundation yourselves?
He tells me I should do as he does, pray for a miracle.
And you don't believe there'll be one? Now Brother Raymond turned completely to look at Beauvoir face on. The anger, so evident a moment earlier, all gone.
Just the opposite. I told the abbot he could stop praying, that the miracle had happened. God gave us voices, and a most beautiful chance, and an age when they can be sent around the world to inspire millions while making millions. If that isn't a miracle, I don't know what is.
Beauvoir sat back and looked at this monk, who not only believed in prayer and miracles, but believed God had granted them one. The silent order would make money with their voices and save the abbey. But the abbot was too blind to see that what he prayed for he already had. Who else knows about the foundations?
No one. I only discovered the problem a couple of months ago. Did some tests, then told the abbot, expecting him to tell the community.
But he didn't. Frère Raymond shook his head and lowered his voice further, glancing around at his brother monks.
He ordered the trees to be cut, but told the brothers it was for firewood, in case the geothermal ever fails.
He lied? The monk shrugged.
It's a good idea to have an emergency supply of wood, in case, but that wasn't the real reason. None of them knows that. Only the abbot and me. He had me promise not to tell anyone. Do you think the prior knew? I wish he had. He'd have saved us. It would be so easy. One more recording, and maybe a concert tour. We'd have enough to save Saint-Gilbert.
But then Frère Mathieu was killed, said Beauvoir.
Murdered,
agreed the monk. By who?
Ah, come on, son. You know as well as I do.
Beauvoir shot a look at the head of the table, where the abbot had risen to his feet. There was a shuffling as the other monks and Sûreté officers also got up. The abbot gave the benediction over the food. When he'd finished, they all sat, and one of the monks walked to a podium, cleared his throat with a little cough, then began to sing. Again, thought Beauvoir with a sigh, and looked longingly at the fresh bread and cheese so tantalizingly close. But mostly, as the monk sang, Beauvoir thought about this straight-talking, no-crap monk beside him, who was one of the prior's men, and who considered the abbot a disaster, and worse, a murderer. When the monk finally stopped singing, other monks brought vats of warm soup to the table, made from the vegetables Beauvoir had helped harvest that morning. Beauvoir took a hunk of warm baguette and smoothed whipped butter onto it and watched it melt. Then he cut a slab of blue and brie from the cheese board making the rounds. As Brother Raymond continued his liturgy of the faults in the monastery, Beauvoir took a spoonful of soup, with carrots, peas, parsnips and potatoes bumping together in the fragrant broth. While he found it difficult stopping the near-biblical flood of words from his companion, Beauvoir noticed that the chief was having difficulty coaxing just a few words out of Brother Simon. Gamache had met many suspects who refused to speak. Mostly they sat cross-armed and belligerent across a hacked-up old table in some far-flung Sûreté outpost. Eventually, the chief inspector had gotten them all to talk. Some had confessed. but at the very least, most had finally said far more than they expected, or certainly intended. Armand Gamache was very good at coaxing indiscretions out of people. But he wondered if he might have met his Waterloo with Frère Simon. He'd brought up the subject of the weather. Then, thinking that might be too mundane for the abbot's secretary, he asked about St. Cecilia.
We found a statue to her in Frère Mathieu's cell.
A patron saint of music, said Simon, concentrating on his soup. It was at least a start, thought the chief, as he cut a piece of camembert and smoothed it onto a hunk of warm baguette. And one mystery solved. Frère Mathieu prayed every night to the patron saint of music. Sensing a small opening, Gamache asked about Gilbert of Sempringham and the design of the robes. That brought a reaction. Frère Simon looked at him as though he'd lost his mind, then went back to eating, as did Gamache. The chief took a sip of the cider.
A nice drink, he said, replacing his glass. I understand you trade blueberries for it from a monastery in the south.
He might as well have been speaking to the camembert. Had this been just the stunningly awkward social occasion, Gamache would have given up and probably turned to the monk on his other side. But this was a murder investigation. He didn't have that option. So the chief inspector turned back to Brother Simon, determined to breach his defences.
Rhode Island red.
Frère Simon's spoon lowered into the broth, and his head slowly turned to look at Gamache.
Pardon? He asked.
His voice was beautiful, even in that single word, rich, melodic, like a full-bodied coffee or aged cognac, with all sorts of subtleties and depth. Gamache realized, with surprise, that he hadn't heard more than a dozen words from the abbot's secretary their whole visit.
"A Rhode Island red," Gamache repeated. "A lovely breed. What do you know about them?" "Well, they have fantastic plumage, and are, in my opinion, dismissed far too easily."
Gamache, of course, had no idea what he was saying, except that it sounded good and might appeal to this man. For a small miracle had occurred. The chief inspector had remembered a single sentence from all the conversations he'd had with the abbot. Frère Simon had a fondness for chickens. Gamache, who did not have a fondness for chickens, could remember only one breed. He'd been about to say Foghorn Leghorn when the first miracle occurred, and he remembered just in time that that was a cartoon character, not a breed of chicken. Camptown racetracks 5 miles long. To the chief's horror, the cartoon character's favourite song had insinuated itself into his head. Duda, he fought it off. Duda. He turned to Frère Simon, hoping this conversational sally had worked. Duda. Duda. It's true they have nice temperaments, but be careful. They can get aggressive when annoyed, said Frère Simon. With those three magic words, Rhode Island red, Gamache hadn't simply breached the monk's defences, the gates were now thrown wide open, and the chief inspector was marching in. Gamache, though, did pause long enough to wonder what could possibly annoy a chicken. Perhaps the same things that annoyed Frère Simon and the other monks, pressed together in their tiny cells. Not exactly free range, more like battery monks.
You have them here? Gamache asked. Rhode Island reds?
No. They're hardy, but we find only one breed works well so far north. The abbot's secretary had turned completely in his seat towards Gamache. Far from being taciturn any longer, the monk was now almost begging Gamache to ask the question. The chief, of course, obliged.
And what breed is that?
Hoping, praying, Frère Simon wouldn't ask him to guess.
You'll slap yourself for not knowing, said Frère Simon, almost giddy. I'm sure I will. It's the Chanticleer.
Frère Simon said it with such triumph, Gamache almost did slap himself for not guessing. Before realizing he'd never heard of the breed before.
Of course, he said. The Chanticleer. What a fool I am. A fabulous chicken.
You're right. For the next 10 minutes, Gamache listened as Frère Simon gestured, drew pictures with his stubby finger on the wooden table, and spoke non-stop about the Chanticleer. and his own prize rooster, Ferdinand.
Ferdinand? Gamache had to ask.
He just seems so majestic, explained Frère Simon.
A name, then, for the emperor, and not the Abba song, said Gamache.
Simon actually laughed, to the surprise and near consternation of the monks directly around him. It was doubtful they'd ever heard that sound before.
Truthfully? Asked Simon, leaning toward Gamache. I also had the Abba song in mind.
The monk sang the familiar tune, a single phrase about drums and guns. Gamache felt his heart leap, as though it wanted to attach itself to this monk. Here was an extraordinarily beautiful voice. Where others were glorious for their clarity, Simon's was beautiful for its tonality, its richness. It elevated the simple pop lyric into something splendid. Here was a man filled with passion. Granted, it was for chickens. Whether he was passionate about music, or God, or monastic life, was another question.
All the doo-da-day.
Your boss seems to have made a conquest, said Frère Charles, leaning into Beauvoir.
Oui.
I wonder what they're talking about.
I do too, said the doctor. I've never been able to get more than a grunt out of Frère Simon, though that makes him a great gatekeeper.
I thought Frère Luc is the gatekeeper.
He's the portier, the doorkeeper. Simon has another job. He's the abbot's guard dog. No one gets to Dom Philippe except through Frère Simon. He's devoted to the abbot.
And you? Are you devoted?
He's the abbot, our leader.
That's not an answer, mon frère, said Beauvoir. He'd managed to turn away from Frère Raymond toward the medical monk when the maintenance monk had reached for more cider.
Are you one of the abbot's men or the prior's men?
The doctor's gaze, friendly before, now sharpened, examining Beauvoir. Then he smiled again.
I'm neutral, Inspector, like the Red Cross. I just tend to the wounded.
Are there many?
Wounded, I mean.
The smile left Frère Charles's face. Enough. A rift like that in a previously happy monastery hurts everyone.
Including yourself?
Oui, the doctor admitted. But I really don't take sides. It wouldn't be appropriate.
Was it appropriate for anyone?
It wasn't anyone's first choice, said the doctor, an edge of impatience in his friendly voice. We didn't wake up one morning and pick teams, like a game of Red Rover. This was excruciating and slow, like being eviscerated, gutted. A civil war is never civil. And then the monk's gaze left Beauvoir and looked first at Francoeur, beside the abbot, then across the table to Gamache.
As perhaps you know.
A denial was on Beauvoir's lips, but he stopped it. The monk knew. They all knew.
Is he all right? Frère Charles asked.
Who?
The chief inspector.
Why shouldn't he be?
Brother Charles hesitated, searching Beauvoir's face. Then he looked down at his own steady hand.
The tremble in his right hand. He returned his eyes to Beauvoir.
I'm sure you've noticed.
I have, and he's fine.
I'm not asking just to be nosy, you know. Frère Charles persisted.
A tremble like that can be a sign of something seriously wrong. It comes and goes, I notice. For instance, his hand seems steady right now.
It happens when the chief is tired or stressed.
The doctor nodded.
Has he had it long?
Not long, said Beauvoir, careful not to sound defensive.
He knew the chief didn't seem to care who saw the occasional quiver in his right hand.
So it's not Parkinson's?
Not at all, said Beauvoir.
Then what caused it?
An injury.
Ah, said Frère Charles, and again he looked across at the chief inspector.
The scar near his left temple.
Beauvoir was silent, regretting turning away from Frère Raymond and the long list of structural disasters and other disasters visited upon the abbey by incompetent abbots. Dom Philippe, prominent among them. And now he wanted to turn back, to hear about artesian wells and septic systems and load-bearing walls, Anything was better than discussing the chief's injuries, and, by association, that terrible day in the abandoned factory.
"If you think he needs anything, I have some things that might be helpful in the infirmary."
"He'll be fine."
"I'm sure he will."
Fréchal paused, and his eyes held Beauvoir's. "But we all need help sometimes, including your chief. I have relaxants and painkillers. Just let him know."
"I will," said Beauvoir. "Merci."
Beauvoir turned his attention to his meal, but as he ate, the words drifted in through Beauvoir's own wounds, sinking deeper and deeper. Relaxants. Until they finally hit bottom and came to rest in Beauvoir's hidden room. And painkillers.
Chapter 21. When lunch was over, Chief Inspector Gamache and Beauvoir walked back to the prior's office, comparing notes. Beauvoir on foundations and Gamache on chickens.
"These aren't ordinary chickens, but the Chanticleer," said Gamache with enthusiasm.
Beauvoir was never sure if the chief really was that interested or just pretending, but he had his suspicions.
"Ah, the noble Chanticleer," Gamache smiled. "Don't mock, Jean-Guy."
"Me? Mock a monk?"
"It seems our Frère Simon is a world expert on the Chanticleer. It was bred right here in Quebec by a monk."
"Really?" Despite himself, Beauvoir was interested. "Right here?"
"Well, no, not in Saint-Gilbert, but in a monastery just outside Montreal, about 100 years ago.
The climate was too harsh in Canada, he thought, for the regular chickens to survive, so he spent his lifetime developing a native Canadian breed, the Chanticleer. They almost went extinct, but Frère Simon is bringing them back."
"Just our luck," said Beauvoir. "Every other monastery makes alcohol, brandy and Benedictine, champagne, cognac, wines. Ours sings obscure chants and breeds near-extinct chickens. No wonder they almost went the way of the dodo. But that brings me to my lunch-table conversation with Frère Raymond. Thank you for that, by the way."
Gamache grinned.
"Talkative, was he? You couldn't get your monk started, and I couldn't get mine to stop. But wait till you hear what he had to say."
They were in the Blessed Chapel now. The monks had dispersed, off to do more work, or read, or pray. The afternoon seemed less structured than the mornings.
"The foundations of Saint-Gilbert are crumbling," said Beauvoir. "Frère Raymond says he discovered it a couple of months ago. The abbey won't stand another 10 years if something isn't done right away. The first recording made them lots of money, but not enough. They need more."
"You mean the entire abbey might collapse?"
asked Gamache, who stopped dead in his tracks.
"Boom, gone," said Beauvoir. "And he blames the abbot."
"How so? Surely the abbot hasn't been undermining the abbey, at least not literally.
Frère Raymond says if they don't get the money from a second recording and a concert tour, they can't save the monastery. And the abbot won't allow either."
"Dom Philippe knows about the foundations?"
Beauvoir nodded. "Frère Raymond says he told the abbot, but no one else. He's been begging Dom Philippe to take it seriously, to raise the money to repair the foundations."
"And no one else knows?"
Gamache confirmed.
"Well, Brother Raymond didn't tell anyone. The abbot might have."
Gamache walked a few paces in silence, thinking. Then he stopped.
"The prior was the abbot's right hand. I wonder if Dom Philippe told him."
Beauvoir thought about that.
"It seems the sort of thing you'd tell your second in command." "Unless you were at war with him," said Gamache, lost in thought, trying to see what might have happened.
Did the abbot tell the prior that Saint-Gilbert was literally crumbling? But then continued to hold firm against another recording, and continued, even in the face of this news, to refuse to break the silence that would allow the monks to tour and give interviews, to make the millions and millions it would take to save the abbey. Suddenly, the second recording of Gregorian chants went from a possible vanity project on the part of the monks and Frère Mathieu to something vital. It wouldn't simply put Saint-Gilbert entre les loups on the map, it would save the entire abbey. This had become no mere philosophical difference between the abbot and the prior. The very survival of the Abbey was in the balance. What would Frère Mathieu have done had he known?
Their relationship was already strained, said Gamache, starting to walk again, but slowly, thinking out loud. His voice low to avoid being overheard. It gave them the appearance of conspirators in the Blessed Chapel. The prior would have been in a... On seeing Gamache's face, Beauvoir shifted his words. In a rage.
He was already in an effing rage, agreed the chief. This would have propelled him right over the edge.
And if faced with all this, the abbot continued to refuse a second recording, I bet Frère Mathieu would have threatened to tell the other monks, and then the ship... But Beauvoir could think of no other way of putting it.
It certainly would, agreed Gamache.
So? The chief stopped again and stared into space, putting the pieces together to form a similar but different image.
So?
He turned to Beauvoir. Maybe Dom Philippe didn't tell his prior that the foundations were crumbling. He's smart enough to know what Frère Mathieu would do with that. He'd be handing his adversary a nuclear bomb of information. The cracked and rotting foundations would be the last and most potent argument the prior and his men would need.
You think the abbot kept the information to himself?
I think it's possible. And he swore Frère Raymond to secrecy.
But if he told me, said Beauvoir, wouldn't he have told the other monks?
Perhaps he felt the promise he made to the abbot only extended to the community, not to you.
And maybe he's had enough of silence, said Beauvoir.
And maybe, said Gamache, maybe Frère Raymond lied to you, and he did tell one other person.
Beauvoir considered that for a moment. They heard the soft shuffling of monk feet in the Blessed Chapel, and saw monks walking here and there, hugging the old walls, as though afraid to show themselves. Gamache and Beauvoir had kept their voices low. Low enough, Beauvoir hoped, but if not, it was too late now.
The prior, said Beauvoir, if Frère Raymond was going to break his promise to the abbot, he'd have gone to Frère Mathieu. He'd have felt justified if he thought the abbot wasn't going to act.
Gamache nodded. It made sense, in the logical little world they just created. But so much about the lives of the monks didn't seem logical, and the chief inspector had to remind himself not to confuse what should have been, what could have been, with what actually was. They needed facts. If Frère Raymond told the prior, Patron, what do you think would happen next?
I think we can guess. The prior would have been enraged.
Or maybe not, Beauvoir interrupted, and the chief looked at him. Well, maybe the abbot, in staying silent about something so vital, had finally given the prior the weapon he needed. The prior might have pretended to be angry, but in fact he might have been ecstatic.
Gamache imagined the prior, saw him getting the news about the crumbling foundations. The fact the abbot knew and was apparently doing nothing, except praying. What would the prior then do? Would he tell anyone else?
Gamache thought not, at least not right away.
In a silent order, information became a powerful currency, and Frère Mathieu was almost certainly a miser. He'd never have shared that information so quickly. He'd have hoarded it, waited for the perfect moment.
Gamache couldn't be sure, but he thought the prior would probably ask for a meeting with the abbot, someplace private, not overlooked, not overheard, with only the birds and the old-growth maple and the black flies as witnesses, if you didn't count God.
Again, though, the chief shook his head. It didn't fit all the facts. One fact, supported by witnesses, was that it was the abbot who had sought out the prior, not the other way around. Except, Gamache thought back to one of his interviews with the abbot, in the garden, when the abbot admitted it was the prior's idea to meet. Only the timing was the abbot's. So, the prior had asked for the meeting. Could it have been about the foundations? And the scenario shifted again, to the abbot sending his private secretary on a fool's errand, to find the prior and ask him to meet later that morning. Frère Simon leaves, and the abbot has his office, his cell, and his garden to himself. And there he waits, for Frère Mathieu, and the assignation he'd secretly set up,
not for after the 11 a.m. Mass, but after Lord's. They go into the garden. Dom Philippe doesn't know for sure why the prior wants to meet, but he suspects. He's brought a length of pipe out with him, hidden in the long black sleeves of his robe. Frère Mathieu tells the abbot he knows about the foundations, demands the second recording, demands a lifting of the vow of silence to save the monastery. Or in chapter later that day, he'll tell all the monks about the foundations, about the abbot's silence, about the abbot's paralysis in the face of crisis. When Frère Mathieu brings out his bomb, the abbot brings out his pipe. One weapon is figurative, and the other isn't. Within seconds, the prior lies dying at the abbot's feet. Yes, thought Gamache, imagining the scene. It fit. Almost. What's wrong? Asked Beauvoir, seeing the unease on the chief's face.
It almost makes sense. But there's a problem.
What?
The neumes. That piece of paper the prior had on him when he died.
Well, maybe he just brought it with him. Maybe it's nothing.
Maybe,
said Gamache. But neither man was convinced. There was a reason the prior had the paper, a reason he died curled around it. Could it have something to do with the rotting foundations of Saint-Gilbert-Entre-les-Loups? Gamache couldn't see how. I'm all confused, Beauvoir admitted.
So am I. What's confusing you, mon vieux?
The abbot, Dom Philippe. I talked to Frère Bernard, who seems a good guy, and he thinks the abbot's almost a saint. Then I talked to Frère Raymond, who also seems pretty decent, and he thinks the abbot's first cousin to Satan. Gamache was quiet for a moment.
Can you find Frère Raymond again? He's probably in the basement. I think that's where his office is. Ask him directly if he told the prior about the foundations.
And if a pipe was the murder weapon, the killer probably got it from the basement, and might have taken it back. Which, Beauvoir knew, made the strappy, chatty Frère Raymond a pretty good suspect. The prior's man, who knew about the cracks, who loved the abbey and believed the abbot was about to destroy it. And who better than the maintenance monk to know where to find a length of pipe?
Except.
Yet again, Beauvoir came up against the fact that the wrong monk had been killed. All that fit, if the abbot had died. But he hadn't. The prior had. I'll also ask Frère Raymond about the hidden room, said Beauvoir.
Bon. Take the plans. See what he thinks. And look at the foundations. If they're that bad, it should be easy to see. I wonder why no one noticed before.
You think he was lying?
Some people do, I'm told.
It goes against my nature to be